lot of the issues that we've been discussing already in this workshop. So what am I going to do? I'm going to present you the results of one empirical study that we did, followed by a brief conceptual interlude, the results of two more studies, and then my remarks trying to tie these studies together and tie them to the themes of the workshop. The first study asked the question, what do people actually think about trade-offs between equity and efficiency? Something interesting has happened in the discourse of global health, I think, in the past 15 to 20 years, and it's evidenced by looking at two major World Health Organization reports. In 1995, the World Health Organization's first World Health report began by pointing to extraordinary gaps in life expectancy between low and high income countries. That's a typo. That should actually be about 35 years, life expectancy gap. And in particularly, life expectancy gaps between countries that spent very little per capita annually on healthcare and public health compared to those that spend quite a bit more, orders of magnitude more. Full stop. About 13 years later, the WHO's Commission on the Social Determinants of Health led off with repeating basically similar numbers. The rather unfortunate thing is that the numbers hadn't changed much. The life expectancy gap had dropped from 35 to 30, but was still huge. But it also ended its prologue with a call regarding social justice. And I'll read a full quote here. Within countries, not just between countries, the differences in life chances are dramatic and are seen worldwide. The poorest of the poor have high levels of illness and premature mortality. But poor health is not confined to those worse off. In all countries, at all levels of income, health and illness follow a social gradient. The lower the social economic position, the worse the health. Putting right these inequities, the huge and remediable differences in health between and within countries, is a matter of social justice. So this shift from focusing entirely between countries and between country inequalities to within country inequalities, I think this reflects sort of a sea change in thinking. So this led my colleagues and I to ask the question, well, this is the expert discourse on what our global health priorities should be. What do people actually think? And there are many, many different ways we could answer that. We decided to try taking one cut, one way of trying to answer this. So here's what we did. We looked at the World Health Organization's World Health Survey. This was a large survey conducted in between 2002 and 2003 in 70 countries. They made every effort to make the population of the survey representative of the populations of all the countries they surveyed. As you can see, they made every effort to select from countries from each income group in each World Health Organization or World Bank area of the world. They had a total of 222,000 responses. They surveyed a large group of questions regarding health behaviors, health outcomes, utilization of health care, exposure to different determinants of health, sociodemographics, and also attitudes about health, health care, and in one exercise, health and health equity. So we focused in on this one exercise that they did. And here's what the exercise was. Some of you may be familiar with it. What they did was they had a series of five cards, and each of the cards had something written on it. And these are the five things that they had written on it. And they asked people to prioritize. And they literally said, place these cards in the order that you think is most important. Right? So what should be the main health goals of your country? As you'll see, number one, improving the health of the population. Number two, minimizing inequalities in health between people. Three, improving responsiveness of the health system. Four, minimizing inequalities or disparities in responsiveness. And five, fairness in financial contribution. So there are two axes going on here. This is asking people to prioritize both in terms of equity and efficiency. Roughly speaking, should we prioritize, for example, minimizing inequalities in health or improving the health of the population as a whole? The other axis is looking at health care or health system responsiveness and population health outcomes, right? So two of the questions are on on responsiveness of the health system, either improving the responsiveness or minimizing inequalities in responsiveness. The other two are simply looking at health outcomes, and the fifth is fairness and financial contribution. So what did we ask? Two pretty simple questions. First, what were people most likely to rank as the number one priority? Second, who was most likely to rank minimizing inequalities number one? And when I say who, we mean individual attributes. So individual, you know, is it people with more or less education, people with more or less higher or lower socioeconomic status, people with more or less satisfaction with healthcare? We also were looking at if there were country-level trends. Do people from different countries or kinds of countries seem to state different preferences for ranking or prioritizing? What were people most likely to rank number one? Here are the results. By a large margin, 58% preferred improving population health as the number one goal. Right? Everything else in terms of number one goal was sort of clustered towards the bottom. The first thing you may note, I've highlighted in blue all the equity-related responses. So if you're a fan of ranking equity, and I use that in very much scare quotes, equity-related goals number one, you are in the minority globally. In fact, about 75% of people ranked improving population health as the first or second goal, and similarly, 75% of people ranked either improving population health or improving health system responsiveness as the number one goal. I'll make another caveat, which is an important caveat. You're probably thinking, what a random way to try to figure out what people's preferences are. You are arbitrarily choosing what people rank number one and saying this is how we should rate preferences. Absolutely. And this is a fundamental problem with trying to use empirical data to understand people's preferences and the distribution of preferences, which is what are you actually going to use to evaluate people's preferences? So this is the way we did it. There are many other different ways to do it. We actually did additional analyses where we did rank ordered regression to try to determine what were people most likely to rank ahead of or behind inequality. And we found that in general, people generally were ranking inequality or equity kinds of considerations lower because they were ranking efficiency measures higher. Second question, these are global averages of the 220,000 people that took the survey. Were there any trends? We found there were some trends. The most striking trends, or the strongest trends, statistically speaking, were ones associated with countries. We found, for example, that in general, ranking inequalities or ranking equity measures first was associated with residents in a country with higher GDP per capita. So the higher the GDP per capita, for every $10,000 GDP, people were 5.5% more likely to rank inequality, minimizing inequality, as the number one measure. We found that people living in healthier countries were more likely to rank minimizing inequality higher. And we found that people living in more equal countries, at least in terms of child health, were more likely to rank minimizing inequality higher. Okay? Why did we choose these measures? These measures were available for the countries that were in the survey. This is what we got. We use this as a proxy for equality. We use this as a proxy for health. We use this as a a measure of GDP. In general, in the individual level, the results were somewhat mixed and very, very minor. We found an overall trend that people in the highest quintile in terms of income in a country were slightly more likely to rate improving health system responsiveness and minimizing health inequalities higher. This is the GDP per capita. We also found a very strong regional difference, which was countries, people living in the Eastern Mediterranean were the most likely to rank minimizing health inequalities highest. So just to recap, what did we find? Efficiency clearly dominated over equity as a primary health system goal globally. Three out of four people ranked efficiency as goal as number one. Those most likely to prefer equity over efficiency as a goal tended to be higher SES, lower education. They tended to be from healthier, wealthier, and more equal countries and or from the Eastern Mediterranean. Well, so what? I think that the important thing is, how do we interpret these findings? So there are multiple ways of interpreting what we found. One is that preference for equity seems to be a luxury of advantage. If you live in a country that already has pretty good health outcomes, that has high GDP per capita, and is already pretty equal, you seem to perhaps be more likely to support privileging equity concerns. Or conversely, if you live in a country with poor health outcomes, poor health care, and a lot of inequality, you may be more likely to rank efficiency higher. Or the opposite may be true. It could be that preference for equity is a driver of advantage. It could be that people who have underlying preferences for equity, for some reason, that results in a society that does better. We don't know. These are equally plausible, at least methodologically. Something else could be responsible for both. We could punt to culture. We could punt to something else, saying, you know, something that defines these groups of people makes them both likely to support programs that will improve health, grow GDP, and have a preference for equity concerns. Which of these interpretations we use, obviously, I think, has a real impact on policy considerations and perhaps even our understanding of procedural, how people will play a role in procedural justice concerns. I think this has significance in terms of our preferences for between and within country equity. If it is the case that countries who already have worse health are privileging overall population health improvement, another way of saying that is they are focusing on between country equity. They want to bring their overall population health up to the standards of other countries, right? And are less concerned with within country equity. Whereas we in the privileged, wealthy, healthy countries seem to be more focused on equity. And I think if you believe our findings are valuable, this could pose a real problem for the renewed or the new focus on improving within country equity. I think a second question of this significance is, does this kind of evidence have any role in decision-making, particularly decision-making with respect to global health? I know there's a literature on the role of empirical ethics. I'm aware of Dan Houseman's work on this, where he says there might be a role, but it is not a determinative role. We shouldn't be putting these things up to a vote. I haven't found anything that satisfactorily says what we should do with this evidence. Should we say, well, you know, so what? Or should we say we should take this into account? And if so, how should we take into account? I think the final significance says, if we do think there is a role for this kind of empirical evidence, or more broadly, if we think there is a role for trying to understand global preferences about equity and efficiency, this is going to require new methods of gathering information on preferences. We have to take into account the fact that preferences may systematically vary, and they may vary with circumstance, but we don't know if that is a cause or an effect of the circumstance. And perhaps most importantly, that these preferences may be highly susceptible to framing effects, okay? I.e., the way the questions are asked. So here's the interlude on framing effects. So when I was circulating an early draft of this paper, Kristen Voigt read it, and she noticed something that very embarrassingly we did not notice, which was, if you look closely at the way the question is asked, these things are not really particularly parallel. And they're not parallel in very important ways. Here's one way they're not parallel. These questions talk about populations, right? Population lives longer. All people should have equal chances of being healthy. Every household should pay a fair share, right? This talks about the entire population. This talks about social groups specifically. All people, no matter their wealth, social status, sex, age, religious, or other beliefs. So there is an implicit and implied difference, right? In these questions, we're talking about populations. In these, we're talking about social groups, right? These questions are framed in different ways. Another thing that's important is that this question in particular is way more detailed, right? This is, well, all people should have equal chances of being healthy. This says we should improve the responsiveness of the health system, and here are a bunch of ways how. Okay? It's very difficult. This very much confounds this kind of evidence, okay? And it confounds it in very particular ways. In particular, it introduces a framing effect of individual versus social group difference. It also introduces something that psychologists call an unpacking effect, which is, are you having more or less detail with each question? Now, in some respects, this is just a methodological question, and the answer is, well, this contaminates your data so badly that we should just throw it away, and really they should do the next World Health Survey and just pay more attention to the way they're asking the questions. I think that's probably, the second part is probably true. I hope the first part isn't. But from all my reading of the literature, it is very difficult to ask questions about equity and efficiency without running into framing effects like this. And then what do you do? If we care what people think, and we need to ask them questions to figure out what they think, and there are always going to be these framing effects, what are we going to be actually getting at? So speaking of framing effects, our second question. Are judgments regarding equity and efficiency specifically subject to framing effects? So part of the background reading, which I'll assume you all read, but just in case you didn't, I'll give a very, very brief recap, was an article that my colleagues and I recently published in the Milbank Quarterly, where we looked at different ways of measuring inequality. And here I'm basically going to be echoing things that Yukiko already talked about yesterday in a much more highly simplified version. This is a graph of black and white cancer prostate cancer and mortality rates among men, obviously, per 100,000 in the U.S. between 1990 and 2005. You can see a couple things very clearly. Number one, the trend for both groups has gone down. And number two, there has been a persistent gap between the two. Now, Yukiko asked something yesterday. She said, we need to monitor inequalities because we need to know how we're doing, where we're going, right? Not just do we have just health, a just distribution of health, but if there are trends, are we getting closer to or farther away from a just distribution in health? How are we doing?
What's the number?
Oh, that's mortality rate per 100,000. Okay. Yeah, so 80 per 100,000. Yeah, 100,000 population, right, of men. So if I ask the question, is the situation better or worse in 2005 than in 1990? We could probably come up with answers. We could have some intuitive judgments of this, right? As we argued, your answer to that question depends a lot, in part, on the way you measure it. The two simplest ways of measuring this inequality are to use the rate ratio and the rate difference, a relative measure and an absolute measure of inequality. And what's happening here is, if you take the rate ratio, you'll see that over this period of time, it's actually increased. It's increased by about 16%, right? So relatively speaking, the inequality has gotten bigger. In absolute terms, the rate difference has actually decreased from 42 per 100,000 to 31 per 100,000. So literally, and I mean the word literally, there are two equally plausible ways of describing what's going on. And those equally plausible ways of describing what's going on lead to opposite conclusions to the question, how are we doing? One conclusion is we're doing worse because inequality is going up. The other is we're doing better because it's going down. Okay. In fact, I can mount a whole bunch of evidence for both cases, worse or better. If I want to support the case for doing worse, I can say, well, the rate ratio has gone up 16%. The relative total decline among whites is higher than among blacks. In 2005, we were less equal, and whites have benefited more from whatever it was that caused these drops in prostate cancer rates. Probably not screening, though that's what everyone assumes. I can also make the case for we're doing better. Look, mortality has declined among both groups. The rate difference has dropped 26%. The absolute total decline in blacks is higher. In 2005, we were more equal, and blacks have benefited more. And, moreover, everyone has benefited. There is no a priori technical reason for preferring one measure. We can't just punt to the epidemiologists and statisticians and say, you figure out the best way to measure this, tell us, and then we will make our moral evaluations. Okay? They're equally acceptable. As we argue in the paper, different measures embed particular, at least implicit, normative judgments. The relative measures, the rate ratios, they're often used because they're blind to base rates. That's what makes them useful. But in this case, they embed an implicit, independent normative significance of equality. If you're looking at the rate ratio, you care only about equality. Right? Absolute measures are sensitive to differences in base rates and to the context of health improvement or not. If measures systematically influence judgments, thus it may be possible to smuggle in normative judgments. If I show you only one measure or another, it stands to reason that I may be able to influence your judgment of what's going on and whether it's good or bad. Sounds nice. Is that really true? Well, we decided to test it out. So we conducted a cognitive psychology experiment where we decided to try to see if this might be true. This choice of measure actually influenced judgments. What did we do? Well, we did what psychologists love to do, and I will again give the caveat of, as the psychologist I work with is fond of saying, we produced something that was perfectly consistent and internally valid, and we make no proclamations about generalizability or external validity, particularly from 40 McGill undergrads. Be that as it may, here's what we found. We subjected all these undergrads to a computer-based cognitive psychology experiment. Here's what we did. Here's what we asked. First, does the framing of inequality data in absolute or relative terms actually influence judgments of inequality? Is the theoretical proposition that we have proposed actually true in practice? And second, might this impact support for different health interventions? So these might look familiar to many people in this room. We actually showed people these kinds of bar graphs. Okay, it's showing up difficultly. Basically, we showed them what we called raw data at time one, which consisted of this graph, and we said, this is the number of deaths in two populations from a made-up disease. Right? Why made-up diseases? Because we want to control for people's moral or otherwise interest in particular diseases. So we don't say HIV, we say spondylitis gomatosis, literally. Right? The blue graphs represent population A. The red graphs represent population B. This represents the mortality rates before and after some intervention. So before the intervention, the mortality rate was 1,000, or the number of deaths, I should say. It's not the rate. It's just absolute figures. The number of deaths in this population was 1,000 versus 500, and in this it was 200 versus 95. I don't know why these came out different font, but in the actual experiment they were the same font size. And we asked them, was the inequality between population A and B, has it decreased, increased, stayed the same, or you don't know? So that was time one. And we gave them a whole bunch of these things. Then we gave them another task, and on to time two. And what do we do at time two? We again showed them the same graphs, but we randomized them to also being shown an inequality measure. So half of them saw the rate difference before the intervention and after the intervention. The other half were shown the rate ratio before and after the intervention, right?
Half of them saw this, the other half saw that.
We also varied mortality and survival frames. For those of you who are familiar with this, this makes a difference. We found actually no difference in this. Okay. We also varied the size of these. So in some of these cases, this looked bigger than this, and vice versa. We also varied the conditions so that in some cases, these measures agreed with one another, and in some cases, they disagreed. Right? Here's what we found. Oh, we also asked them, would they support this intervention? Both, would you support it? Should the intervention continue? And if so, how much money of a putative tax increase would you be willing to devote to it? So here's what we found. First, we found pretty much broad support for supporting the intervention, and we found that if people believed that inequality was decreasing, they were more likely to support the intervention. Right? So equity appeared to matter. It didn't trump everything because they still supported interventions even if it was increasing. This was true both in an abstract sense, would you support it, and also true in how much money would you give to it. And psychologists like to give both of these because it's easy to say yes, it's somewhat difficult and somewhat more different to say, and I would give this amount of money to it. Here's what else we found. We found that, as we had predicted, giving people an actual inequality measure was highly influential on their answer. So, let's just look at this scenario. In this scenario, the relative measure of inequality was increasing, the absolute measure was decreasing. Right? Everyone was shown the raw data, right? And as we would expect, everyone essentially said, or there was agreement between the two randomization arms, right? Before, people generally said, only 35% of people said inequality was increasing. Very few, if any, people said, I don't know. So what this means is roughly 60% of people said it was decreasing. That is, when shown only the raw data, people tended to agree with the absolute measure. But after being shown an actual measure, they diverged. We changed their minds. Remember, we showed them the exact same data, right? When they saw the same data, we had significant movement. We had significant movement in all of the scenarios where these disagreed. They were inconsistent. Where they were consistent, as we would expect, there was broad consistency. Before and after, there was almost universal agreement on what was going on. To represent it graphically, at time one, people agreed. By time two, when we had interpreted it for them, they disagreed. Okay. So what did we find? Individuals' assessments of raw data tended to agree with absolute measures. Providing an inequality measure did, in fact, influence individuals' judgments regarding changes in health inequalities. This was particularly strong when you show people relative measures. It was particularly strong in cases where the measures disagreed. And individuals who believe that inequality is increasing are somewhat less likely to support an intervention. Okay, so what? Well, what do we make of the baseline agreement with absolute measures? Is this significant? We've gone around and around in this. We thought, well, does this mean that people's intuitions, if I just show you just the facts, just the data, and people tend to say, I think inequality is X, and X happens to agree with the absolute measure, can we then conclude that's people's intuition? I don't think so. But maybe so. Is it significant? Framing matters. Individuals' intuitions differ when shown raw data or inequality measures. This is sort of a no-duh point. Sure, if you package information the right way, we all know we can all lie with statistics, right? But I think there's a deeper message here, which is it's not just that we can lie with statistics. It is that we can frame statistics in an entirely valid way that will change people's minds about the rightness or wrongness of a situation and their willingness to support an intervention. I guess the big question is, what do we make of this? A lot of behavioral economics likes to play around with the straw man assumption that there are rational economic actors out there and say, no, we're predictably irrational, or whatever you want to call it. Is this some evidence that the idea that there are rational moral actors is a fallacy? Are individuals just highly manipulable? Are people just stupid and innumerate? Or are we somehow fundamentally undecided about this? I don't know. All right, so what? All right, this is all nice, but you know, it stands to reason that this is not rocket science. It's probably true that when people report inequalities, they're very careful to report all the required measures. And in fact, there are multiple reporting guidelines that explicitly state you should always report absolute and relative measures, and you should give very good reasons for why you're choosing one or another. Right? Just what Yukiko did yesterday. So we said, all right, is this true? So we did a structured review, which is sort of like the redheaded stepchild to a systematic review. It's structured, and we had criteria for doing it, but it is not statistically systematic. What do? We picked the calendar year 2009. We picked the top journals in epidemiology, medicine, and public health that report health inequalities information. That's them. We searched the entire year for all original articles reporting original research data on inequalities in health. The original search returned 646 articles after reviewing, 1,646. Sorry. Yeah. What did I say? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Trust me. I went through the abstracts of all these articles, and there were 1,600 of them. We wound up with 344 after review. I can give you all the flowchart, and I can give you all the exclusion criteria and all that good stuff if you really want it. You're already giving us too much information, right? So what we asked was, what inequality measures did these articles actually report, first in the abstract and then in the full text? Why? I've heard that a lot of people only read abstracts. I've heard, especially people in policy or who aren't actually epidemiologists or public health people, may be prone only to reading the abstracts. So it matters. We also asked if they provided only a relative, and then we coded exactly what they reported. And we also asked if they reported only a relative measure, could you have gone back and calculated the corresponding absolute measure? Right? Did they just choose to do this, but they gave you enough information to say, well, if you're interested, you can go and do it yourself? Here's what we found in numbers. I'll give it to you in colors. In the abstract, it's a little hard to see. 88% reported, 88% of the articles that had a number, a measure in the abstract, which was a total of 140, reported only a relative measure. Right? So there were 344 total. In the abstract, 140, roughly, reported some measure, and the vast majority of them only a relative measure. In fact, only three of them actually did what the recommended guidelines say and said and reported both. It wasn't much better in the full text. In the full text, roughly three-quarters of all articles only gave relative measures, and for roughly half of those, 46%, you couldn't even get to the absolute numbers underlying it if you wanted to. Now, one caveat, there are certain kinds of epidemiological studies where it's impossible to do this. We're doing an additional analysis to see how often that's the case. But if you read the literature, if you read only the abstracts, you're getting only relative measures. And even if you go through the whole full text, you're really likely to be exposed only to relative measures. So there is, in fact, a strong systematic bias to reporting only relative measures of inequality. Okay? And in general, fewer than 10% of all the articles in this year reporting on health inequalities actually did what the guidelines say you're supposed to do. So to conclude, I've got some general remarks where I'm going to try to draw this together. Again, what did we find? We found a general, though stratified, preference for efficiency over equity globally. We found that the literature on health inequalities exhibits a systematic bias toward reporting health inequalities in relative terms, and we found some evidence among McGill undergraduates that this kind of selective reporting could indeed impact their assessment of the rightness or wrongness, or direction of inequality trends and their willingness to support health interventions. Why does it matter? I think it matters for three reasons. First, in case of making decisions about prioritization. Second, how we think about expertise and the role of intuition in judgments about health inequality and equity efficiency trade-offs. And third, in the case of context. I'll start with context. You might think I've cherry-picked the prostate cancer example and manufactured this idea of relative and absolute measures disagreeing, and that this is probably, you know, this might happen every once in a while. I can't give you actual percentages of how often it happens, but in the context of successful medical and public health interventions, it happens quite frequently. If we look at the introduction of highly active antiretroviral therapy and its impact on racial inequalities in health, we see that after the introduction of HART in 1995, it had a dramatic increase on mortality for blacks, among whites, and among other races. If you look at the rate ratio, it shot up. If you look at the rate difference, it shot down and plateaued about 3 or 4 years. We can tell two radically different stories about the introduction of HART. I can say, you know what? The introduction of HART seems to have exacerbated inequalities. There's something about the way that this medicine is distributed in the United States, and it's entirely plausible, given the healthcare system of the United States, that it is so inequitable that things actually got worse. When we came up with a drug that made things better, we actually made things more unjust. And indeed, if you look at the literature, people do conclude this. I'm not making this up. Right? So there was a recent, 3-year-old article in the American Journal of Public Health that concluded precisely this using only relative measures. Right? You could conclude the opposite. You could say, you know what? Actually, it made things better, at least until 1998, and since then, inequality has plateaued. If you want to look at trends in infant mortality across the century, I can tell exactly the same story. Look, this is an extraordinary public health success, both in terms of population health, efficiency, and in terms of equity. Look at that gap. It's gone from gigantic to almost non-existent. Right? Wrong. In relative terms, since about 1920, things have gotten worse and worse and worse in absolute terms. Blah, blah, blah. I could pick out a bunch more. When we introduce successful medical and public health interventions, it is a mathematical fact that this kind of thing can happen. And this has real repercussions for our judgments of whether it is right or wrong. I think this, in turn, has ramifications for how we prioritize equity and efficiency. I think it has ramifications for how we answer the question, when is one situation worse than another regarding inequality? Very important question that I gathered from a book that Larry Temkin wrote that I did read. What's that? Not just the abstract. I think it's on the first. I think it's on the fourth page, actually. But seriously, when is one situation worse than another regarding inequality? Many different ways to answer. I think this also may have something to say about the role of intuition in our judgments about equity and efficiency. How do we know what people really think? If we, McGill undergraduates, but I'm going to make the leap because there is a substantial amount of literature showing that actually absolute and relative framing, not of inequality, but of health outcomes, has an impact on people's judgments, whether they are adults or undergraduates. It does among physicians. It does among health policymakers. Not of inequality, but the general framing of impact expertise seems to provide little, if any, protection against these framing effects. We love to think it does, but it does not. How are our moral intuitions influenced by hidden normative assumptions and biases built into evidence presentation? I'm going to make a very obvious point, which is when you're talking about health inequalities and population health, you have to rely on empirical evidence. You have to rely on numbers because you are making judgments about numbers. And if there are these biases built into the way the numbers are generated and presented, what does that mean about our intuitions and our ability to gather and aggregate these intuitions? Are experts more reliable? No. One final thing that Yukiko mentioned yesterday. I think we should be much more transparent about the choices that go into which measures we're using and why we're presenting data in different ways. I'm not sure that transparency offers a solution. I think it's a great buzzword. While we should be transparent, people should always give their reasons. It's not entirely clear to me that that's going to solve the problems here. To sum up, I want to thank my collaborators in all this work, Sam Harper and Meredith Young. I want to thank the CHR for underwriting all this work, and I want to thank Chris and Adina for giving me the chance to present this work. Thanks very much. So, any questions?
Okay, we'll start with Colin.
I found that very interesting and unfamiliar territory for me, but let me just give a very brief anecdote. So last year, my hockey team made it to the finals, but barely won any games during the season. This year, we won many games during the season, but did not make it to the finals. If you ask, did we have a better year this year than last year? My answer is, in some respects, yes. In some respects, no. Right? So when you ask, like in your first frame of the time
experiment.
One, right, the experiment,
yeah.
Right, you gave the students these choices, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's decreased, it's increased, stayed the same, don't know.
Yeah.
It seems to me, if I was taking that test, or I would be frustrated, right? Because I might want to say, in some respects, better, in some respects, worse, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering whether, in some context, we want to make an all things considered judgment about the moral acceptability of a policy where there are trade-offs, right? But in other cases, we think that there is a divergence among two things we care about, but we think that it didn't have to be that way. And so we think it's regrettable, right? And it can be misleading, it seems to me, to suppose that we have to always make the sort of unidimensional judgment as to whether things got better, when in fact we're inclined to say, you know, it's complicated,
yeah.
Right? And moreover, just more generally, in addition to framing effects, it seems to me there's just background information effects that are hugely significant, right? So I don't know what people were told when in the initial data that you reviewed, right?
The World Health Survey.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but before I take that survey, like, if you had told me, if I'm, a citizen of a poor country and said, you know, your life expectancy is 35 years shorter than it is in Canada,
yeah.
Right? It seems to me that might have an impact on whether I care about equality or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. The boring answer is, yes, I think what our research shows is that people aren't even being given the opportunity to even consider yes in some ways, yes in some ways, no. They're essentially being told yes or no. And when I say people, I'm saying not just McGill undergraduates, I'm saying health experts, health policymakers, and so forth. And these normative assumptions are built into the measure. So yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it may seem fantastic, but I genuinely believe that every time someone publishes this data, they should address that question, right? They should say, I'm going to give you all the acceptable ways of measuring this, and if I'm going to make a recommendation or in the discussion, I'm going to say, I think that the situation is getting worse and we should do X because of this. But they aren't, either out of convention or out of wanting to show the greatest effect, which relative measures do. That's the boring answer. The less boring answer is, you're a smart guy, very smart guy. You can see that, right? Is the assumption that if everyone were as smart as you, they'd also say in some cases yes, in some cases no? I don't know. Right? Is the answer here, well, every single person who consumes this information should be educated in exactly what I'm saying? I don't know. I think Yukiko had her hand up too.
Well, Yukiko first, yeah. Yeah.
Yukiko, go ahead. I'm so sorry. Go ahead. My hand from next time on like this, so people see. Good presentation. Thank you very much. And you know I'm very interested in this topic. And my comments and questions, probably comments, are around this absolute and relative measures. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising to me that relative measures are mostly used. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's not surprising to me because a lot of measurement or index are like really influenced by income inequality literature. Mm-hmm. So income inequality measures are relative measures mostly. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that, one thing is that the absolute measures here you're presenting as absolute measures are those one when in the up there. If we are comparing two subpopulations, 1,000 minus 500, that's absolute measure. But then if we made that choice, we are also in the measurement making the choice that when the mean changes in the absolute difference. So 500,000. 1,000 and then 1,500, and then those differences are the same. That's our judgment. So that's the same thing, and the relative measure is the same. So the income inequality measures are relative because they wanted to avoid the problem of inflation. Mm-hmm. So the inflation happens, and then we don't want to say that the inequality, income inequality increased because of inflation. So to avoid that problem, income inequality measures are relative measures, and then health researchers started to use it, and because of, the literature is established, and we can learn a lot from it, so we're using it. And then actually, that's 2 years ago, one of the conferences, it was quite neat for the Atkinson to comment on health inequality measurement and literature, and he was saying that you guys can't do that. Income inequality measures are there with that thought. And then so maybe it's time to think about it. And then he was kind of implying that then maybe when we think about health, people might think about absolute difference. So your result of people thinking more about absolute difference is an interesting one. But I wonder that if it is either or, just then reading Larry's work and then thinking about this issue, I think I'm kind of combining relative difference and an absolute difference somehow in my head and I make decision. And depending on probably different levels. So when the very, very sick population or very, very high healthy population, I might be combining those things differently. And the measures that tries to do that is probably, intermediate inequality measures. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not quite sure on the top of my head that then how you can test that assumption of interaction or how that's going on. But then it would be very interesting to look at not the either or presentation, but then you allow that combination of the judgment and then also different levels of health. I think that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I think you're right that the importation of measurement techniques from economics into public health has driven a lot of this. Although I would also say that there is a general tendency in public health to always report relative measures. I mean, we're not talking about Gini coefficients here. The vast majority of the literature that we surveyed was just using odds ratios or rate ratios, incredibly simple measures, which I don't think that comes from economics. I think that comes from public health, both a technical judgment that we like to use measures that are not sensitive to base rates or population sizes. They're useful for comparing different diseases, different times. They're useful technically for a lot of reasons. But I think it's sort of mere convention rather than a reasoned decision based on moral preferences. As far as using composite measures, I'm a big fan of this idea, and I'm a big fan of your efforts to do it. The one thing I would say is I'm sort of two minds, because on one hand, I really support the idea of trying to present people with information as uninterpreted and unframed as possible, if that is at all possible, which would mitigate against the idea of making a bunch of choices and presenting people with measures where these choices have already been prefigured for them. On the other hand, I'm a fan of making plain our decisions about that. So I don't know.
I have one general remark mm-hmm. and then one particular comment on mm-hmm. the first set of empirical research. Mm-hmm. So general remark is that when I studied economics in Japan, statistics professor first in the first class, he said, data never tells a lie, but liars always use data.
Mm-hmm. So what does that make me?
So I don't know, take like, you know, class of Atkinson inequality measures.
Yep.
There are different measures within that class. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you suggested, you know, maybe there's different kind of results or intuitions we can derive mm-hmm. depending on which particular measure we use. So I think it's conscientious scholars, only thing conscientious scholars can do is to offer different measures mm-hmm. and then different results, and then just reminds readers of different interpretations. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I think, that's good enough, and I think that they should do. Mm-hmm. So that's first general remark. Mm-hmm. The particular one is the first empirical research. Mm-hmm. So question, it's not matter of framing effect, it's more like a badly phrased questions mm-hmm. or options. So for example, first option, second option is entailed by first option, probably. Because first option says, as I can see, is that the total health of population is strictly increasing function of individual health. That's it. So like a just consequentialism. The second option is egalitarian consequentialism. Mm-hmm. So people who choose second option take the second option to be conjunction of first and second one. So it's not surprising. So it's second option is that strictly increasing and strictly concave function of people's health. So it's people assumes first one is satisfied, then as an extra option, people choose second option. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, it's not surprising, you know, healthier society tend to choose second mm-hmm. option because first option is already satisfied.
Already satisfied, yeah.
Yeah. So the question, the two options should be presented in a more mutually exclusive way. So first one is improving the health of population regardless of, you know, inequalities amongst individuals or social classes. Then I think people start choosing different options. Mm-hmm. And probably I can see more people choose second option rather than first option. But probably you didn't choose this particular
option. No, I didn't do
options,
the survey.
So
yeah.
It wasn't under, you know, control of your research. So yeah. It's unfair criticism, but I just wanted to say just matter of phrasing of options rather than framing effect.
Yeah. I mean, on your first point, I agree. I think that's what conscientious scholars should do as well. Whether it'll happen, I don't know. That's a really good point about the possible assumption that people would assume that number two is subsumed under number one. Should they be presented in a mutually exclusive sense? I don't know. I don't think that engineering the questions so that they're mutually exclusive, it will give you answers to one set of questions, which is, if these had to be mutually exclusive, which would you prefer? You know, in the real world, they are not necessarily mutually exclusive. So again, this is why I present it as a question rather than a conclusion. If we are serious about understanding people's preferences regarding equity and efficiency, right now there is a push in global health to look at within-country equity, right? An expert push, right?
Standard economics assumes that
they're mutually exclusive. Yeah.
Divide the state of affairs
divide
the universe
into mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive states of affairs. And then we define preference ordering over that set of states of affairs, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's fair. Otherwise, people should be allowed to choose two options. So two options as a number one. Then it's okay, even if we have a overlapping. But if we have a strict ranking and strict preference ordering, then options should be as mutually exclusive as possible.
Yeah, it's a good point.
My question was on a similar issue, namely the question of whether you control for the factual assumptions that people make about equity and efficiency. Mm-hmm. So if you tell somebody, choose between equity and efficiency, and the person has the background assumption that actually the two go hand in hand, that the cheapest way to improve health is to improve equity, i.e. to focus on the worse off because there you can make improvements more cheaply, then they may say, just focus on health improvements, assuming that this will take care of equity. Right. The second question is very small. That's, I think your first slide or the second, you were inconsistent between what you said and what you had on the slide, namely the life expectancy, was there a decline or an increase? On the slide, it said 25 years for the earlier life expectancy gap, and orally you said 35.
Right, it was a typo.
You said it was a typo.
Oh, you did say that?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So you're right on the second. Regarding the first, we could not control for that. We controlled for a wide range of socio-demographic factors. We couldn't control for background information because the people who did the survey did not provide background information and didn't get that information. The one thing I would say about that is if background information of that kind were to explain the associations that we found, that would have to mean that background information is somehow patterned in these ways, that people who live in high GDP countries systematically, regardless of individual socioeconomic status or demographic characteristics, have different background assumptions from people who live in low GDP countries and so forth. I don't know. That could well be a case. It is plausible to a certain extent, but I don't know. So yeah, this is the problem with using data that someone else has collected. You're bound to their collection methods, and until I get the money to survey 220,000 people across the world, that's what I've got to work with.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll try to make this quick. You say, are we serious about people's preferences? Well, for one, I don't really care much about people's preferences, I'm afraid to say. But mainly I'm going to say that in the context of Awal's concern, which is whenever I look at these kinds of studies, the wording of the questions seems to me so poor that you can interpret them to mean almost anything. And that's got to make your results, how much weight you want to put on people's preferences. If I thought we were actually eliciting people's informed preferences, where they knew what was at stake and what was involved with background conditions and so on, then I might be much more tempted to take seriously people's preferences in this domain. But even the simple five questions you asked, I mean, if I took apart each question one by one, I could tell you why I would be worried about believing the answers of any one of those. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them have a parenthetical remark which is supposed to be explaining what came before it, and the parenthetical remark is just a completely different claim. And like your point, is that the first or the second I'm responding to when you get a question like that? minimizing inequalities in health between people may or may not be the same as all people should have equal chances of being healthy. This is kind of ex ante versus ex post, the kind of stuff I was talking about yesterday. Mm-hmm. So who knows what people are responding to when they answer these questions. Again, not your fault, mm-hmm. but until we have a really carefully formulated set of questions we have some confidence in, and we know what people are actually responding to when they answer one way or the other, I don't know how much weight we should put on that. Second of all, I just want to make a small plug, much as I love the fact that Yukiko, based partly on my book, wants to combine the two measures. I think we should be in favor of relative like measures. Mm-hmm. And I argue so in my book, and I'll just say mm-hmm. a word about that, just a short word. That doesn't mean racial measures, which is how they tend to be. Mm-hmm. Racial measures, we know, are deeply problematic. As you approach zero, if you go below zero, those are all sorts of problems. I suggested another more complicated way. But the point is, if you care about equality, meaning you care about how people fare relative to others, if that's the fundamental concern, that's an essentially comparative concern. Mm-hmm. And the concern about how people fare relative to others does have to have a relative notion, not an absolute notion. So it isn't just an accident, I don't think, nor is it just the fact that people were influenced by the economics models. It's that's the best way of thinking about equality, insofar as you care about how people fare relative to others, which is, I want to claim, the fundamental concern about a certain key core aspect of inequality. And the simple example of that is if you just had a parent, they had $300 to divide up between their two children, and they said, $300, I'm going to give you $100 and you $200. We think, that's horrible. One person gets like 33% of what there is to have. On the other hand, if they had $2,100 to spend, and they said, okay, I'm going to give you a million and you $1 million, you know what, I'm going to throw an extra $100 your way. Well, we still might think, no, you ought not to do that. You ought to make it, 50 and 50. But the difference between getting $1 million and $1,050,000 out of $2,100,000 is insignificant. You've got, as it were, 49.99, whatever it is, percent of what there is of an absolutely equal share. So I think there's powerful arguments, if you care about equality as a comparative notion, to favor a relative notion. Ratio is a mistake, can't be racial, but it's mm-hmm. got to be basically relative, which the ratio approximates a lot better than absolute.
Mm-hmm. I'll make my response quick since there are a lot of people. In terms of caring about people's preferences, I think it's easy to say I don't care about people's preferences. There's been a lot of talk today and yesterday about procedural justice, which I'm not an expert, but I take to mean, at least in part, establishing procedures for aggregating people's preferences, people who matter. If you're going to do that, you have to establish a procedure whereby people can accurately communicate and represent their preferences if they so exist. And I think I'm saying I have a lot of skepticism about our ability to do so with the tools we have at hand, whether it's aggregating 220,000 random people across the world, or it's aggregating or somehow deliberating between experts who are in using informed judgments informed by data. I think I'm just providing skepticism. And I could say, well, then the idea of preferences we can throw out the window, but then what? Someone's going to be making the judgment, and I can't see anyone who I trust as being above any of these problems. Maybe I misunderstood your question. As for the second, well, I'll just do that for now.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for this. So I come from a philosophy background, and so I find it really interesting because we usually don't even care about these things. So
even less after today.
Well, who knows? No, so far I do care. So, but I did care before. Anyway. So I don't really have it's not a question, it's not that much of a, what I want to say is not that much of a question insofar as it's more a suggestion maybe to complexify your analysis so the way I understand what you said is so some, cognitive biases could influence our perception mm-hmm. of what are health inequalities. So, and the one you have emphasis mm-hmm. is the one relative to whether it is expressed in terms of absolute or relative numbers. Mm-hmm. But there are many other cognitive biases that can influence our perception, of course. So, and my favorite one is, so I've been spending time on Wikipedia while you were talking, and so my favorite one is the confirmation bias, so which is the tendency to search for or interpret information in a way that confirms one's preconception. This is related to the concept of cognitive dissonance. So I was wondering, so this is really interesting and really convincing, but it might be important also to consider all the other things, all the other biases that could influence our perception of health inequalities. And they might not always, how to say this, they might not always mutually enforce each other. Sometimes they might play against each other. And there's many other things that, so that was my point. Thank you.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. If you have more interest, come work with us in our lab. The one thing I will say, I mentioned it in passing, that in this, embedded in this experiment, we also varied mortality and survival frames. And this is a very famous cognitive bias. If I'm a doctor and you're a patient and you're suffering from a disease and I have a treatment and 9 out of 10 people who take the treatment survive, I could say to you, I've got a treatment that's 90% effective, or I could tell you I have a treatment that has a 10% failure rate. And we know from the literature that both physicians and patients will favor the treatment when you say it's got a 90% survival rate. And there's also an economics literature about how we are risk averse more in terms of loss. We tested that, and to the best of our understanding, that actually had no impact. We were very surprised. We thought it might actually have a bigger impact. So I couldn't agree more that I'm not cavalierly going to say, oh, there are all these cognitive biases and it messes us up. I think they're very, very particular, and we should study them in particular situations. So, thanks.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Not for us. It's for
Is there a green light?
No.
If the green light is on, that's all.
Okay, sorry. I guess my question sort of comes along with Dominic's one. So I was thinking about, how to report this and what sort of effects and things. And I get the point about if you do only the relative ones, because, this is so subject to potential manipulation, whether it's deliberate or not. And then the version back is to say, well, we do absolute and relative, but that can't be the case either, because, surely the relative one you pick is still going to affect, right? I mean, I assume that in the studies you saw where people do both, that they don't do absolute and then the two options of the relative, the way that you're doing it. So my guess is that when they report relative one, they still pick a frame, right? So which means that presumably is still going to have an effect, which leaves you back to pure absolute things. But then you have the whole seepage. So in your example there with, the 1,000 and the 500 and the 295, I mean, I think a lot of people would basically say, well, I like the sort of the efficiency component and I can just re-describe it as an inequality one. So, you have two compatible frames and you just pick the one and this gets you into confirmation bias and so on. So where does that leave us? Well, one way basically tells us that, well, no matter what we do, we shouldn't take these preferences very seriously, or alternatively, we should really investigate under which context particular relative measures are really the ones that are most appropriate. But that is a form of manipulation. So in some sense, what I'm saying, maybe manipulation is not a bad thing, provided we can justify it and we're much more clear about this. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, there are a whole boatload of very naive assumptions that all this work is based upon. People actually read the literature. People who make important decisions actually read the literature, and they actually read it closely. And the more transparent you are, the less likely people are to be subject to confirmation bias, and they're not just going to pick out what they like. Go back to Gopal's talk. He presented a slide of education-related mortality rates across Europe. It was very interesting. They presented both the ratio measures and the differences, right? Did you look at both? Did you look at one or the other? Why? What did that do? Did you actually go through the process of saying, okay, there are two ways of reporting this. They're doing what I want them to do. I think most people, myself included, tend to look to the ratio measures because I say to myself, what's the difference between 155 in southern Spain versus 214 in Norway or something. So, yeah, I think it's a naive assumption to think that if you provide all the data, that we can wash our hands, basically. That's why my last point, would transparency really make a difference? Or are we always going to choose the data that confirms our biases ahead of time? So I vehemently agree with you. But if I said to myself, these assumptions are so naive, I can't do the research, then I would have nothing to do with my time. So
two very quick points, one for each half of your talk over here.
Yeah, hi. Sorry.
One's a comment, one's a question. So on the second half and the framing things, so it picks up a little bit what you said recently. I was a little bit surprised when you started going into the framing effect discussion and you had those questions that you didn't flag when you were comparing them. So, you know, gain-loss asymmetry, there was also that in the questions. The two questions that people like the most are framed in terms of improving something, improving a good, and the other ones are framed in minimizing a bad.
Yeah, that's a good
so
point.
You also get that.
Yeah.
Question in the first half, this is very short. So you presented the kind of, you know, report on preferences of inequality measures versus other things, and then you presented these two kind of hypotheses about kind of the direction of causation. Mm-hmm. So people in worse circumstances are more interested in kind of improving their outcome, kind of.
Yeah.
Or is it that the preference for equality kind of... My question is, do you really think those are on a par? You said that, but do you really mean that?
I think they're both plausible. Do you mean, do I think they're equally plausible?
Yeah, or even close.
No. But if I'm being true to my data, I shouldn't frame it as, well, you know, I really think it's this. Because... frankly, based on what we found, I cannot say this is more likely. And, you know, this is probably the most likely. Door number three is probably the most likely, but this is what I think. And, you know, when we wrote it up and sent it to reviewers, we have to say, but yeah, just in this room, yes, I think that this is much more plausible.
Okay, thank you. I also found it very interesting. Can you go back to the relative versus absolute inequality?
Tell me when to stop.
Very study you had where you asked these McGill students, right?
Yep.
I was the first one. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether... I know that the text says that they ask whether inequality is decreased or increased, but... I can't help thinking that somebody may be blind to the fact that all things considered, after the intervention, this is simply a better outcome, right?
Yep.
And so I'm thinking whether you'll get the same intuitions if you actually had a situation where you leveled down.
Yep.
I may be stepping in other questions, but I don't know if you had some considerations about that included in the questions you could have.
Please come work for me,
okay.
Because this is our next experiment, right? Because you're right, this is all leveling up.
Yeah.
And in the context of leveling up, yeah, we found broad, well, depending on how you interpret it, we interpret it as we found pretty much general support for this, which you could furthermore interpret as, in the case of leveling up, equity concerns are muted. So we are going to replicate this where there's leveling up, there's leveling down, and the size, the magnitude of the leveling up and leveling down. So... good catch, absolutely. Don't know yet.
Okay. But yeah, good, very good point.
Just one last question. It's a very naive comment that goes back to the role of empirical ethics and the is-ought and is it interesting or not what people prefer. It's very easy to dismiss it being, you know, predominantly philosophers around this table. But these are all political decisions. And in terms of maybe internally for public health interventions, maybe they're made by experts, but at some point they do become political, democratic, well, in some countries, democratic decisions, and what people prefer, efficiency, equality, is going to matter. So knowing what they actually prefer is highly important, and developing the appropriate tools to measure that is highly important. So I'd like to reaffirm the importance of your research, if not from a philosophical standpoint, then definitely from a political one.
Thank you. The only thing I would add is when I say I don't think experts, and I mean health policy experts, public health experts, medical experts, are likely to be any better than McGill undergraduates, I can't prove it, but I really mean it. And the point is not that this is going to impact the people. I'd love it if the people in this room were making all the decisions, maybe. I don't know. I don't know you quite well enough, but I think that would be great. The point is not that, well, we should open this up to 220,000 people. It's that the people who are making the decisions right now are getting certain kinds of information that have systematic normative biases implicitly embedded within them, and they either are unaware of them or it's confirmation bias, and they're unaware of the way that we frame the research really impacts the results that we get. And that's my suspicion. It's not aimed at, you know, Joe or Jane Sixpack in the street. It's aimed at the experts, us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all your comments.